hear me okay? Okay, well, thank you very much indeed for the invitation to talk to you. I'm slightly conscious this is a different type of audience, the one that I'm used to. But just to be clear about what I am going to talk about today, is I'm going to focus the talk around CCTV, but I'm going to relate it to a whole range of other security measures that myself and my colleagues have been involved in evaluating over the last few years. What we try to do in our work is be innovative in the way that we've gone about our evaluation. So I want to talk a little bit about methodology, I want to talk a little bit about findings, and I'll talk a little bit too about some of the research evidence we've produced in the form of films and videos. And I'm going to play you some videos later based on work that we've been doing with offenders. But let's start at the beginning. PRCI, Perpetuity Research and Consultancy International, is a spin-out company from the University of Leicester. What a spin-out company means is that it operates in the business world, but it's partly owned by the university. And the idea is to apply the rigour of academia to develop practical solutions. So we're a hybrid in a way. I often put the situation like this. It's when we're doing work that involves an academic audience, the remit goes something like this. Write at least 10,000 words, make sure you fully explain the theory, outline completely the methodology, you've got room for the findings, try and fit them in somewhere. If you're doing it for the business world, it's in no more than two sides, tell me what this means to me and what I need to do. They really are two very different worlds, and we try and bridge that gap, which is sometimes not so easy. But the idea is to develop from our theory, from our research approaches, solutions which have a practical output. Let me just give you some idea of some of the research that we've been doing. We've been doing a lot of work with security guards, are they effective or not? We've been looking at what drives illicit markets, and notice I use the word illicit market and not black market. On that project, we've been to 18 different countries around the world, and we've traced a product right from the point of manufacture, right to the point on the shop floor, and looked at all the points where security failures occur. We looked at what causes indiscipline in schools, and by indiscipline I don't mean things that enable to get someone expelled, I mean lower level of indiscipline, which disrupts classrooms. We've looked at how shop thieves steal, and I'm going to talk a little bit about this in the talk I give you today, because one of the things we've been doing is we've been interviewing offenders in prison, and we've got some fascinating insights into what offenders say about security measures. We've been a bit further than that, in that one of the problems about interviewing offenders in prison, and I've done a lot of interviews with offenders in prison, is that they're in prison. And of course, the problem is that what they say and how they interpret things needs to be considered by the fact they're divorced from the situation in which they're talking about. So we came up with this idea. What about returning offenders to the scenes of their crime? And so we have. We've been taking offenders back to the scenes of their crime, recreating their offences. And at the same time, we've been getting them to discuss with us exactly how they get round security measures. What are the risks they evaluate? And we video this. And I'm going to play you later on in this talk some of the clips from that videos based on what offenders say about how they get around security measures. So although I'm going to talk about the CCTV evaluation, because that's the main topic today, a major study about the effect of CCTV, I intend to draw upon quite a few of these other studies. I spent a lot of my life interviewing armed robbers in prison, and I'll talk a little bit about armed robbers. We've actually taken some robbers back to the scenes of their crime too. We've also videoed some of them about what they have to say about how they commit offences. We've done a lot of work on fraud. I've just finished a major study interviewing major league fraudsters in prison. That's those who've stolen at least £50,000 from their employer. In fact, on April the 4th, what's that, 5 weeks ago now, we had a major conference in Leicester on fraudsters' perspective on fraud, and I managed to get one of them out of prison for the day to come and talk to us about his experience, and it was a revelation, actually. The audience were absolutely amazed to hear this fraudster speak about how he did it. We've got a project going on at the moment, actually, where we're, and tomorrow I'm in Cheshire, interviewing staff who've been dismissed to find out about their perspectives on what they think about being dismissed. It's no worse than being in prison talking to robbers and murderers, and I'll come to that in a minute. Okay, let me just explain about CCTV though, because the basis for this work is to talk about a national evaluation of CCTV. And if you reviewed all the evidence in the world on CCTV, and one of your colleagues in Cambridge, David Farrington, has just done that, you come to this sort of conclusion. The problem with reviewing all the evidence in the world is it depends on the criteria you use for whether you include something or not, based on the quality of the research, because a lot of it is poor, because a lot of it is done with a self-interest at stake. But even if you include all or just the best, the same finding is here. It's this: CCTV sometimes works, sometimes doesn't, is sometimes neutral, and sometimes makes things worse. Now, given that I said that our objective is to produce findings that are practical and helpful at the sharp end, you can imagine that's not an awfully good starting point. But anyway, that was the starting point on which we conducted a national evaluation of CCTV. That is to say, does CCTV work? Now, the first problem that we had is that when you review the evidence around the world on whether CCTV works, they talk about CCTV as if it's a single thing. But in fact, I would argue that no two CCTV systems are the same. So we're making comparisons. It's easy to jump to conclusions when we're talking about CCTV as if it was a single concept, when in fact CCTV varies enormously within this country, let alone abroad as well. For example, there are open and closed systems and covert systems. There's fixed cameras where they just point at one spot. And then there are those that can move about, pan, tilt and zoom. Then there are those that you redeploy around an area. And then there are those on vans, which are a different sort of thing altogether. So CCTV is not one type. Then you've got the analog versus digital debate. Typically, systems traditionally have been analog, and they're increasingly becoming digital. But most often, they're a mixture of the two in some way or other. And then once you've got all that difference, you've got the process by which images are transferred from one place to another, creating many, many different types of systems. So my first word of caution is that researchers around the world haven't distinguished between these. They don't explain in their reports what they're talking about. They've just treated CCTV as if it is a single thing, and it isn't. And that complicates comparison even more. What we were asked to do was look at 13 systems, actually it's 14 because one was effectively two, that were implemented in a range of different contexts. Town centres, car parks, hospitals, residential areas, mostly residential areas. And this is really quite important actually because up until relatively recently, the CCTV systems that have been installed in city centres and town centres, which was seen as much less controversial than potentially residential areas. And suddenly here the government was going into town and city centres and saying we've got successes when in fact we hadn't, and then going on to say we'll put it in residential areas. Indeed, the situation is frankly amazing. Going back to the mid-1990s, when CCTV suddenly became a popular government strategy, it would have been quite straightforward and logical had the government said this. Had the government said, communities around the United Kingdom, if you've got a problem with crime, we will help you solve it. That would have been a logical thing to say. What they actually said was, communities around the United Kingdom, if you've got a problem with crime and it can be solved by CCTV, we'll give you the money. If it can be solved by anything else, you can't have a penny. So all of a sudden, all around the United Kingdom, we have problems that could be solved by CCTV. Now, that may sound like a bit of an exaggeration, but it really isn't. It really was very much like that. A fortune was made available for CCTV. And the problem was, therefore, is that areas decided that they would need to get some money out of government. And part of the success for a local authority was getting money out of government. What it was for someone else to worry about, you know. Once, and we actually saw in local authority magazines success stories that we've got money out of government to fight crime. The whole process about this was CCTV and we've got to make it work wasn't at the centre of many local authorities' agenda. So it was against that background that we were asked to evaluate the effectiveness of CCTV. And we evaluated schemes that were funded under phase two of the Home Office CCTV initiative. And just to be absolutely clear, all this money was made available for CCTV and nothing else, against a background where the research evidence was at best confused. It would be very difficult to make a case, even if you only included the best research studies, that CCTV had been effective against some sort of criteria. Our approach was to be as comprehensive as possible. This was really quite a major study. We used a combination of experimental design and realist evaluation. Just for clarity, realist evaluation had emerged very much within the social science literature as a response to the problems of experimental design. And what that invites us to consider is what are the mechanisms by which something works or doesn't work. So in a particular context, it isn't good enough to say CCTV will reduce crime. You have to say, what is the mechanism by which it will reduce crime? In other words, it would go something like this. CCTV will spot offenders committing offences, the police will respond, arrest people, the world will find out they're going to get arrested, they won't commit crime anymore. In other words, you'll explain it in a lot more detail. So we looked at both an experimental design and a realist approach. We looked at police recorded crime statistics to measure changes in crime, both in intervention areas and comparison areas. There is a big debate about whether you can use the word control area in this context, but anyway, we used a comparison area. And we also looked at whether there were any changes in crime patterns around the areas at various intervals. Actually, we also looked within the areas at the amount, we call it the viewshed, the amount of an area that could be seen by a camera to see whether there were any movements within an area between where the camera could see and where the camera couldn't see. We conducted public attitude surveys, 12,000 in all actually, both before and after in both experimental and comparison areas. We did in-street and obviously in town and city centres. In other areas, there were residences. We went to their homes, interviewed them. We also, by the way, did a cost-benefit analysis of the work. This was extremely detailed. Every time there was a meeting of the project, we would find out who was there, find out how much they were paid, work out their hourly rate, worked out how much the room would cost to hire. So we broke down into very minute details how much each meeting costs so that we could build up a cost of CCTV. So the idea was that as part of all this, we would be able to come back and say at the end of the day, does CCTV work or not? In addition to the 12,000 members of the public, we spent over 350 hours in control rooms watching what CCTV operators did. We conducted over 300 interviews with members of CCTV schemes. We attended over 200 meetings of CCTV. So no small scale study. And outside of all this and completely separately and nothing to do with the national evaluation, I was also conducting interviews in prison with people about what they thought about CCTV, and I'll come to that in a minute. And I was also, as I've just said, taking people back to the scenes of their crime, where I was asking them to tell me, how did they get round it? And what sort of threat was posed by this image? So they all came together. And completely separate from all this once again, I was doing a separate subtopic, looking at the effectiveness of redeployable CCTV, the ones that you move about areas. So, quite a comprehensive approach, at least that was the objective from the start. We were looking at the way that CCTV implemented. We looked at the bidding for money and how they decided how many cameras they got. Incredible as it may seem, this was very haphazard. If you were to ask me the question, what was the main criteria by which people decided how many cameras they want, I'd be very tempted to say the main criteria was how much money they thought they could get away with claiming for. But that was the reality of this situation. You know, this was often not based on any sort of rigorous approach. The people involved were often very marginal to what was going on. They'd formerly been involved in doing lighting or something else in the local authority, and now CCTV was arrived, that's what they'd have to do. The project management was in many cases pretty poor. People were told that they had to do this in addition to other things, often not having any perspective on it. The whole way in which they engaged stakeholders, not least the community, was frankly amazing. Asking people whether they want CCTV is like sometimes asking people whether they want an ice cream. You know, why would you say no if you like ice cream? It's only later when they say, but you've got to pay for it, that I'm a little bit clearer about what it all involves. And we asked about third parties, the whole process of getting suppliers on board. Incredibly, at one point, they ran out of poles in this country, the poles on which you put CCTV. They started to import these from other parts of the world. And of course, the design and technology was done by people who often didn't have a lot of experience of designing CCTV systems. And of course, the thing about technology, as I'm sure all of you will know better than me, is it moves so fast. And it moves faster sometimes than humans can keep up with. And I'll come back to that in a minute. Right, let's look at the control room. The control room is the hub of where it all happens. The control room is where the operators sit there and look at screens. And the idea is really quite simple. The idea is this. When an operator looks at a screen, the screen contains images of a place, say a city centre. The operator looks at the screen, spots what's going on, sees a problem, calls the police respond, make an arrest, and everything works so simply. And yet, in the 3 years of the evaluation, we hardly ever saw that happen. It's just not what you would think. Now, there are a whole range of reasons why that doesn't happen. The first thing concerns the quality of the operators themselves. They're now statutory regulation requiring all CCTV operators of public space to have a license. But let me just put that in perspective for you. As from March the 20th of this year, the Security Industry Authority, a statutory requirement that CCTV operators require a license in order to view public space. The CCTV user group, the main body representing these people, estimates of the, quote, 10 to 30,000 people requiring a license. How many do you think have got out of 10 to 30,000? They needed it by March the 20th this year. How many do you think currently have it? I guess. Less than 100. It's a statutory requirement. You know, to be honest, the whole security world, and I'll come back to this in a minute, requires putting in perspective in itself. So part of the problem is the operators themselves. Part of the problem is how operators have to communicate with the police. And this idea that they've got a bat line, a bat phone, straight to the heart of the police, often wasn't the case. Often the only way they could report messages was the same way as you and I. The police themselves were often sceptical of what operators were telling them. And in any way, what the police argued to me was this, look, we were busy before we had CCTV. Now we've got images 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, beaming problems to us. What do you expect us to do? There's just no realistic way we could respond to all this. And you know, one of the challenges for the future, and we held another conference on March the 15th in Leicester called A National Strategy for CCTV, was about just what are we going to do with all the images that are being generated? It's okay in a terrorism incident, then all resources problems are put to the side. You know, it's a terrorism incident. But what about everyday events? You know, what do we really expect to happen as a consequence of spotting something? Of course, the other thing is that the police are also getting a bit more realistic as well. You know, in the early days, they thought they would go down there and they would collect their image and walk away, show the offender, and everything would just happen. It would just be an easy prosecution. That is not how it is, often, because the images aren't often good enough to support a prosecution. At that conference I told you about on March 15th in Leicester, one of the police representatives there claimed that 80% of the images that come to them are not good enough to support a prosecution. Now, what do you do? What do you do if you're an offender and you're shown an image and the police say, that's you, and they say, prove it. Prove it was me. And I'll come back to what the offenders say a little bit more in just a minute. Okay. One of the things we had to do, of course, at the same time, was that one of the difficulties on evaluating the effectiveness of anything is the presence of other things that have caused the effect, what are sometimes called confounding factors. So in each of the areas, in both the experimental and the comparison, we tracked over a period of time anything else that could possibly explain an impact. You know, sometimes the police would operate a new operation in the area. Sometimes there would be government regeneration funds and there'd be a massive investment in the area. All of these in themselves could be used to explain what was going on. So we kept a diary of events to try and explain what else might have impacted on the CCTV. We started off looking at 18 schemes. It says something of the incredible incompetence either of government or local authorities in applying for the money. But 2 years after we started the evaluation, four of the 18 still hadn't started. Four out of 18. Even though they were given government money for this. There is actually a bit of an issue about what you count as a scheme starting. Elsewhere within criminology, there's quite a bit of research about this, which is just coming through. It's sort of, in criminological terms, one of the hot issues off the press. In that, if you wanted to do something about a crime problem, the best thing you can do in the short term is tell the public something is going to happen. Because the publicity will generate an early effect. There's been some real cock-ups in research findings, actually, on this. There's a study that was done by the Home Office of Property Marking, okay? And the research concluded that the property marking scheme did have an effect. And all around the world, you will see quotes about property marking works that's focused on this research report. But when you read the research, what you find is that the property marking was applied to property on an estate by the police. Now, I tell you, having spoke to many offenders, and it's probably logical anyway, that if there's one thing sure to make the crime reduce on an estate, is to put police on there all day. It's a good idea. You know, in practice, of course, it's too expensive. I mean, the real reason why that property marking probably worked was because there were police on the estate all day. Sir?
What's property marking?
Property marking is where you put a stamp on a property to say the owner is, or in high streets, for example, they often have a label that says only sold in high street stores. You know the sort of thing that I mean? Only sold in high street. And let me tell you a little aside, on property marking for a second. Last summer, we were asked by retailers to find out from offenders what sort of property marking worked or not. So I managed to get a focus group of 12 offenders. Not easy. They were supposed to turn up at 11. We eventually started at 2 o'clock. Not easy. We got them in a room and we asked them about all these different types of property marking. And it came to this one they were really interested in, where it says on a product, only sold in Tesco's, or only sold in Asda, or only sold in Sainsbury's. And I asked them what they thought. And they said, absolutely makes no difference whatsoever. You can take this anywhere and sell it, and no one takes the blindest bit of notice. And anyway, it's a slight advantage, because if it says only sold in Tesco's, it proves it's authentic. So I really was really quite surprised by what they were saying. So what I decided to do is I took out a market stall. Okay, went to a market actually on the outskirts of London. I did two, one in London, one in the north. I did it the second time because Channel 4 wanted to film this because they couldn't believe it either. But anyway, I took out a market stall, and on the market stall, I had all these goods like razors, batteries, toothbrushes, the things that could easily be that are quite expensive for what they are. And on these, I put a label saying only sold in high street stores. And the idea was to see whether the members of the public would be concerned about the label. And we've been going about an hour, and nobody had asked me about the label. They bought the goods regardless. So we decided to change the tack after an hour or so. And I pretended to be a customer. Right? So my colleague was behind selling these, and I would come up and be a customer. And at the very point that someone was buying, I would arrive at the store. And this is what I would say. I would say, excuse me, to the person selling it to me, obviously my colleague, but no one knew that. This says only sold in high street stores. My colleague would say, so what? And I would say, they could be stolen. And he would say, or she would say to the person buying, excuse me, you're not bothered about the fact they could be stolen, are you? You couldn't get a more leading question, could you? No one was bothered. One lady said to me, turned round and said to me, of course they're bloody stolen. So we've just done some work for Channel 4, and oddly enough, we did some work last week about selling goods in pubs. And, you know, the point about this, though, one of the things to come through is that speaking to offenders is remarkably innovative way, an informative way of finding out about what they think. And many more stories about that in a minute. Okay, so that's what I'm supposed to be talking about on CCTV. We had some real problems in the fact that 14 of the 18 never did implement. There's also a real issue when you're dealing with areas in finding a comparison or control area, whatever you want to call it. Indeed, one of the reasons why people argue it could only be called a comparison area is because it's never possible to find an area close enough to call it a control, similar in key characteristics. And it's certainly a great problem. Of course, there couldn't be any random allocation either. It wasn't the nature of the beast. Now, also, incredibly, and perhaps you in your world will know more about this than I do, although it was an unbelievable finding for me, is that although this was sponsored by the Home Office and police data is owned by the Home Office, the police wouldn't give us the data. And they wouldn't give us the data because they said they weren't allowed to under data protection. And so we had a real convoluted 18 months trying to get data out of police. And it caused an enormous amount of problems. Moreover, when we started the project, at the interview, when they were giving us the money, they said, all the data we give you will be geocoded data, which is marvellous to work with for those of you who know about this thing. In fact, in the event, none of it was geocoded data. And so both the delay problems, the delay problem is a real one for me, actually, because the research director had appointed staff to get the project going, and four of the 18 never started. You know, had I known what I known at the end, what I knew at the beginning, I wouldn't have appointed so many staff at the beginning. But there we are. These are the real world of doing research. You know, the problem about people is it's not a laboratory. It's not a pure science. And therein lie some of the challenges of social science compared to natural science. Let me give you some results. I'm going to sail through these a little bit because I'm always halfway through my time. There's lots of exciting things I'd like to tell you about other things we've done. But let me tell you about the impact on crime. In fact, it was pretty poor. Only six showed a substantial reduction in crime in the target area compared to the control area, but only two of these were statistically significant. And in only one of them could the change in crime levels be traced to CCTV. In the other one, there was so much else going on, it just wouldn't be right to say that CCTV caused it. And so for those who were hoping that we'd come back and say, i.e. the government, CCTV is a great success on crime levels, I'm afraid it wasn't. We looked at the impact in different areas, and to be honest, they tended to show very varied results. The best one that came through was on car parks, and there's lots of research, including misquoted research, which says, including misquoted research from me, which says CCTV is most effective in car parks. I think a better way of putting this would be CCTV is more effective when you've got absolute control over an area, and that's easier to do in car parks than it is in town and city centres. But, you know, the world doesn't quite work like that. I know when this all came out, it was published last year, I had to put a quote in the press release. And the quote I put was, CCTV doesn't work when not managed properly. And what was published was, CCTV doesn't work. Well, not quite the same thing. And so, you know, there's many, many misquotes about the sorts of things that we found. Impulsive crimes were less likely to be reduced than premeditated crimes, as you'd probably expect, although most offences actually were trend shows, very much a reflection of national trends anyway. We found that increased camera density, that's the number of cameras, was related to the effect only when the cameras had not reached saturation point. So where it was saturated, it actually didn't do a lot more good. So not only was it a waste of money, it also didn't actually have a good impact. And as I've said before, there was a much better effect when you can control the number of entrance and exits. We did look at displacement quite closely. One of the Achilles heels of not just CCTV, but a range of security measures is that all they do is displace. If you look at the research evidence on displacements, it suggests that claims that displacement occurs on a big scale are exaggerated. It certainly can occur, and we found limited amounts of it, but it's not generally the case. And when I tell you a little bit more about what offenders say, you understand why that might be. We did a lot of public attitude surveys. The public were very interesting, actually. They overall, when you look at their views, they were very enthusiastic about CCTV. Britain is a little bit isolated in the world in terms of its enthusiasm for CCTV, but the British public have always been big supporters, and they were beforehand, but their experience dwindled a bit. What we found is that if you were to ask about fear of crime, now fear of crime is a really difficult thing to measure. And when people talk about it in the press, they talk about fear of crime as if it was just a concept that everyone relates to. I mean, if I ask you, are you scared of crime? You can see, well, maybe you always are. I mean, maybe I'm always scared of crime. I'm always scared that something might happen. That's why I take precautions. But I'm not scared in the sense of I don't live a frightened life. So we tended to ask about whether you worry about crime and do you feel safe? A sort of questions that are easier to get answers to. As you can see up there, the worry about crime showed some positive results, although it's important to know that knowing cameras were installed in the area did not necessarily lead to reinforced feelings of security. So we've got to be very careful about tying reduced levels of worry to CCTV. We asked about feelings of safety, and the problem again is about tracing feelings of safety to CCTV. And that is because when you look to all the explanations that could account for why people might feel safer or why people might worry about crime, the main reason was experience of victimisation. If you want to stop people worrying about crime and make people feel safer, make sure they're victimised less. That was the golden lesson. That was the variable that best explains attitudes towards feeling safe. The CCTV role, therefore, is a little bit more distant. And so one of the problems that we've come across here is it wasn't having a dramatic impact on crime. It wasn't making people feel dramatically safer. Could it change their behaviour? Now, if you look at what impact CCTV is supposed to have, of course, one of them was the idea that people would use the town centres and city centres more because now they felt so safe. And beforehand, we asked people, you know, are you going to go out onto the streets and enjoy it? And as you can see up there, people said yes. But when experiencing CCTV, it didn't have that impact. Far fewer, only 1% of respondents said they avoided places, but they didn't go places because CCTV was there. So it didn't change behaviour in any dramatic way, and the public exaggerated beforehand what they thought the impact would be on them. Nevertheless, support was high. It was high even though it went down. So the experience of having CCTV made the public less supportive of it. But the problem, of course, is it was sold as a great thing. I mean, many people said to me, why would the government introduce this if they weren't already sure that it wasn't a good response to crime? You know, a reasonable point. But of course, the government did do it as a response to that, when there wasn't the evidence to support it. As a response, you know, the public are pretty sharp people. And they realise this isn't how we thought it would be. We did actually come across some who were outraged by CCTV. I tell you, one of the other things we did was we did focus group discussion in communities to get their views of it. And they were outraged that crimes were occurring and the police weren't responding. They were outraged that they wanted a CCTV in their part of the town when other parts of the town got it. And some really, really sort of negative views, because no one had thought about managing their expectations. This was seen as an unqualified good. It's an unqualified good that didn't have the impact that was desired. So let's look for a minute about what explains effectiveness. Let's try and bring all this together. And I'll give these slides if anyone wants them, and you can get a copy of the report and download it. There are 9 reports that are available, we've done on CCTV, all on the Home Office website, or which you can access from our company website. So I'll put up the thing at the end. If you want to find out more, you can do so. Let me just begin to explain what was going on here. The first thing is about scheme objectives. Now, in any evaluation, the object of the exercise is to find out what it's supposed to do and then measure to see whether it's done it or not. But what do you do when what it's supposed to do doesn't drive the scheme forward? So in other words, what people said were vague things like, we want to make people feel safer, we want to reduce crime. But how? Because we've got CCTV. Yeah, but how's it going to help? Well, it just will, the government said it would. You know, there was that sort of real lack of thinking about how it's going to work. Just to be clear, by the way, this is not just the government. I honestly believe the world of business, that in many, many cases, they have not got objectives either. And if you were to evaluate why they've got CCTV, you could honestly be forgiven for believing the reason why many have got it is because of the need to be seen to be doing something. Whether it works or not is a different matter. You've got to be seen to be doing something. So let me just present this as some sort of public sector failure. I think there's a general issue about security, which I'll try and come back to in a minute. So the first problem we had was that although schemes did have objectives, they need to write objectives in their bid to get the money, this wasn't what drove the scheme. The thinking was poor. So in the end, it comes back to some very general comments about reduced crime, making people feel safer, without really that being the driving force behind the scheme. The second issue was management. And again, the problem was that people often weren't up for this. That they weren't aware of the technology and how it could work on the one hand, or people and management issues on the other, what's needed to make a scheme work. As a consequence, it was never possible to achieve the objective, not only because the objectives were vague, but because the management wasn't an integrated part of what was going on. There was also extreme vagueness over how many cameras were appropriate for an area. People were learning about this as they were going along. Even where cameras were put was done on the latest set of police statistics, or walk around an area with a police officer so he or she could decide the best places to put them. So that was another factor. Then there was the technical aspects, and there were some real disasters here, I have to say. I'm not just talking about cameras not working. I'm talking about the fact that, let me give you one example. In one scheme, incredible as it may seem, they did a survey of where to put the cameras in the winter. And in the summer, they hadn't thought about the fact that trees grow. You know, they get leaves, and it's a dramatic effect. It's dramatic. You know, you think about it, it's dramatic. It blocks out whole views. It makes cameras redundant. So there are a whole range of issues about the technical aspects. There was a particular issue about lighting, and once again, be forgiven for believing that lighting seen as crucial to CCTV. If it's dark, they can't see. Not quite true, you get special cameras. But by and large, you need lighting. But the trouble is you need a certain type of lighting, because lighting creates glare. And often you couldn't see at night because the lighting used created a glare, which means you couldn't see what was going on. And I'm not talking about the odd isolated example. I mean, you know, this was not uncommon. And then we've got the whole operation of the control room. You know, part of the problem about coming up with a model about what makes things work and what makes things not work is the fact that there is so much that could make it work. I mean, let's just explain to you. For example, you could have a perfectly designed scheme, a great manager, a set of stakeholders who bought into the concept completely, a control room that was extremely well run, and a poor relationship with the police, and it would all fall down completely because the end result wasn't channeled anywhere. So there were some real errors about control room operations. We found operators at night when the manager wasn't there, putting a feet up, going to sleep, reading comments, creating videos, the really sort of naughty stuff going on because they were poorly trained, they were poorly paid. Isn't the sort of job many people want to do. It's frankly very boring. When you're looking at those cameras all the time, those screens all the time, I mean, it really is quite mundane. It's not that exciting. And even a busy street on a Friday and Saturday night is not that exciting. You know, when all you can do is watch everyone else enjoy themselves. So all this has led us to the conclusion that our recommendation was that many people could come away and say, our evidence suggests CCTV doesn't work. But we didn't suggest that. Because, you know, the people involved were really quite pleased with it. They were really quite pleased with its potential. And, of course, there are many examples of where it's been very effective. And, of course, the London bombings is a case in point. We reported before that, but that rather supported our view. But put to proper use, it could be extremely effective. But there's a lot that needs to get right to make this work. Now, let me just tell you at this point about why I've rushed through slightly, because I want to tell you about some other work that we've been doing. That part of the problem for me is that the world of security, and I've used CCTV as an example, but I could have easily spoken in similar terms about security officers, property marking, tagging systems, alarms, all of which we've evaluated, and I would have given you very similar sets of findings. That security has been a poor performer. That by and large, there are too many security failures given the amount that's invested in security. And I sometimes put it like this, that if you were an alien and you came down from outer space and you were an intelligent alien that landed on Earth and you looked around you, you'd probably think, wherever you landed in the United Kingdom, say, probably think these people in this part of Earth are really bright. You know, they've got all these security measures out there. What they've obviously done is they've spoken to the enemy, they've spoken to offenders, found out what they've done, and on the back of this, built a whole security response. Well, intelligent observation alien is exactly the opposite to what has happened. But in fact, people have not asked offenders what they think, and the security world has grown despite what the problems are, not because they've evaluated the problem systematically. You know, and when I came back into academia in 1990, I was intrigued to find out about the offender perspective. Now, a lot of my work is based around what offenders think. And I started to get involved in armed robbery, sort of. I mean, I was always intrigued by armed robbers because in a way it was a rational offence to me. You know, I could see how someone could get to a position where, you know, there's so much to be gained from armed robbery, they were going to do it. I remember one of the first interviews I ever held with an armed. I interviewed 331 robbers, so it was, you know, a big sample. It was a bank robber, right? And the sort of questions I was interested in, just as a precursor, were how did you go about planning your offence? What were the main issues you had to consider? What were the sort of things that you needed to collect before you went out that day? What did you think about the threat of the police? When you were doing the offence, what were you thinking about? How did you choose that target? What made it easy? What made it difficult? Did you use any sort of weapon? Where did you get it from? Would you really have used it? And what sort of circumstances is it viable to take a weapon or to use a weapon? What about the thought of going to prison? Would you do it again? Now, I would have said answers to those sort of questions must surely be fundamental to forming some sort of response. I say surely because, of course, it isn't. That is not what's happened. The response has happened regardless. And this bank robber was one of the first I interviewed. And I soon found that when you ask offenders, why did you choose that target? What a question, fundamental question. I was really pleased with myself for thinking I could focus in on this. And the answer is typically because it was easy. So you say, well, why was it easy? Well, because it is. Not very helpful. So you have to break these things down and say, you know, was it on a corner? Yes, no, was it relevant? Did he have an alarm? Was it relevant? Anyway, at the time, it's bank robber. The question was about screens. You know, the screens that go from the counter to the ceiling. And this is one of the first interviews I did. The question was this. Before you walked into the bank, did you know whether there was a security screen? He said, yes, absolutely. I said, did the screen affect the way you did the robbery? He said, yes, absolutely. I said, in what way did it affect the robbery? He said, I only rob banks with security screens. So, you know what? He wasn't the only one to say that. And it's only an illogical answer if you're not an armed robber. Because let me tell you why. Another one of the questions was, when you're doing a robbery, what are you thinking about? What's on your mind? And on a robbery, there were two dominant answers. One, get the money. Yeah, reasonable, eh? Two, even more reasonable, don't get caught. Now, what was the main impediment or the main risk factor to them getting caught? There was one dominant thing they had to worry about. Over-enthusiastic members of staff jumping across the counter. You see, that's the one thing you can't control for. You can control for more than anything, but how are staff going to behave when they're robbed? Some of them don't like it. But you know, I'd rather say that to them. And of course, when you're committing a robbery, it's a worry. You know, you can't control it. You don't know what they're going to do. So what do screens do? Keep out of the way. They're one danger. Robbers used to say to me, what's the big deal? You walk in there, you go up to the counter, say, give me the money. They give you the money, you walk out. You know, what else do you need to do? It's as simple as that. And herein, though, lies the danger of not thinking this through properly. I remember on another story, just to put this in perspective a bit. I was interviewing on a maximum security wing of a prison. And I'd been on this maximum security wing 3 days interviewing these offenders. And, you know, they're not nice places. I mean, some people kid you, it's Club Med. But I've never been to a prison, not even open prison, that is like that. They are all not places you want to go, I suggest. And particularly not maximum security. Anyway, I've been on there 3 days. I couldn't wait to get off. Go home, get out of it. And as I'm about to leave, this great big chap comes up to me. He was about 6'6". He was about 18 stone. He says to me, who are you? I said, I'm Martin Giles. I'm doing a study of robbers. He said to me, I'm a robber. I thought, oh, no. he says to me, I said, oh, that's interesting. I said, would you be interested in helping my study? He goes, yeah, see you at 9:30 in the morning. I thought, oh, no, I've got to stay another night up here. I've got to go back on the prison wing. It's not easy to get into a prison wing at 9:30 in the morning. You know, it's a real pain. But I did. Stayed an extra night, got on the prison wing 9:30 in the morning, and I called him Joe, okay? And I said, could I speak to Joe, please? And he said, no, you can't. I said, why? They said, he was removed overnight for making a gun in the kitchen. I said, oh, where's he gone? Can't tell you, maximum security. So there I was, going home, stayed an extra night, didn't get my interview. 6 months later, I'm on the wing of another maximum security prison. I'm standing there talking to someone. Someone comes up to me and goes, oi, who are you? It was Joe. Now, Joe always denied making the gun in the kitchen, but he was a very interesting character, actually. Joe was a very intelligent man. And I went on to spend a little bit of time with him examining his views of the world. And he was 25 years old, and he'd just got 12 years in prison. And he was absolutely delighted. He reasoned that at 25 years old, he'd serve 8 years, get out when he was 33, and he had a chance to live a new life. You know, he reckoned that he'd robbed cash in transit vans, which are the most difficult type of target to rob, because obviously they move around, but they're the most lucrative too. There's a lot more money to be got out of those than hitting a statutory target. And he made a lot of money. He spent it all, but he made a lot of money. And he was explaining to me that the problem he got is because he was good at it, he kept making money, and lots of money, is that it became a way of life. And he was clearly a very intelligent guy, the sort of guy that you can imagine that had he had a different sort of way from the beginning, would have gone on to great things. But anyway, he said to me, you know something, Martin? if ever I go back to do another robbery, and I'm not going to do it, but ever I do, I'm going to kill the guard dead. I'm going to kill him. I said, but Joe, why would you do that? You're an intelligent guy. He says, you know, because it's the rational thing to do. He says, there are three reasons why I must do that. Point number one is if I kill him, I take away a witness. He can't give a witness against me if he's dead. Point number two, that there'll be no evidence if he can't at the scene. Point number three, that if I kill him and I get caught, it makes no difference to me. If I go robbing again, I'm going to prison forever. Authorities have taken away the reason for me not to kill. When you've got my sort of record, you go down forever. Now, my point is not about the argument for lower sentences. My argument's about how offenders thinking about this at the sharp end. Now, on the work I did with offenders, the most instructive thing of all was a whole range of issues about how they view the world, about the dangers of introducing security measures and not understanding what they're designed to do. Let me put this in the context of CCTV, because I've constantly got 5 minutes, in the context of CCTV. That I wanted to know what offenders thought about CCTV. So I went into prison and I asked offenders, and I'm talking about thieves now, thieves and fraudsters, whether they thought CCTV would stop them offending. And by and large, their argument was no, not really. And the reasons were this, that first and foremost, that if you're committing an offence, you always have to worry about someone watching you. Always. You've always got to worry about someone catching you. Why does that change dramatically? Because you're on a camera that's being watched from another place. It doesn't change the situation dramatically. You're going to worry about being watched. You know, this idea that, you know, you pick things off the shelf and say, yeah, I've nicked it, you know, it just doesn't happen like that. You've always got to worry about being caught. The second thing they said was, well, you can wear a disguise. It's no big deal, you can wear a disguise. The third thing was, they said, we have been caught on camera. But the images are crap. You know, they're just not good enough to support a prosecution. More likely supported by the police. So their argument was that by and large, CCTV did change things dramatically. There was one group, though, who said it was an important deterrent. And they were distinct in one respect. They were distinct because CCTV had been used against them where the image was good. And where it is good, and you get caught, you're in big trouble. In fact, you might as well plead guilty straight away. We're just doing a study right now to look at the use of CCTV evidence to make those sorts of comparisons. But I thought, now, what about this, though? All this was not pointing to a great result for CCTV. And I had this idea. This was it. What if we were speak to murderers? Those convicted of murder, and asked them what they thought about CCTV. So I organised a focus group discussion with 10 murderers. Me and 10 murderers in a room. It was very interesting. As you can see on here. And they were very, very interesting. Really, really, really engaging people to talk to. Obviously, they got some stories to tell. And I said to them, you know, would CCTV have made much difference to you at the time you committed their offence? Now, the interesting thing was, these people had committed their murder in public space. So the idea was that they could have been caught on camera. And you know what they said? Their argument was it wouldn't have made any difference to them. And the reason being is, at the moment they committed that murder, they'd lost it. Typically, amongst that group, the combination of drink and argument, girlfriend's featured largely, meant they lost it. And they just lost control. It wouldn't have mattered if a soldier with a machine gun over them. At that point, they committed the murder. They said it wouldn't have made a lot of difference to them. One guy, however, in that group, he'd gone into an off-licence, a place, for those of you from abroad, a place where they sell spirits and beer, and he'd gone in and stolen a bottle of spirit. And as he walked out the door, the manager caught him. So he hit him across the head with the bottle and killed the manager. and disappeared and drunk his bottle of spirits. And he got arrested the next day and was shown the footage of him committing this offence. And he said that he could not believe what he had done. He'd been drunk at the time, he had no recollection of the event, and as far as he was concerned, he deserved to be in prison. This was a rightful and deserved sentence. So, you see, the problem that I have here is that when I talk about these, it's not that CCTV hasn't made some notable progress. It's just that all too often, for the reasons I've explained, that it's not used effectively and to maximum impact. Now, let me just, I'm getting a little bit out of time here, but what I'd like to do is just take you to the last bit of the thing that I just want to communicate today. And that is the process of taking offenders back to the scenes of their crime. Now, you know, when you've spoken to robbers and murderers and thieves and fraudsters, taking offenders back to the scenes of their crime seems the next thing to do. And, you know, it is a really, really interesting way of finding out about the world of crime and prevention, or more importantly, from my point of view, about the limits of the security response. And it's important to understand not just whether it works or not, but why they say it did or didn't, because that gives you the information that you can use elsewhere. And the usefulness of this was brought home to me with one of the early things we did with shoplifters. And what I do is this. I meet the shoplifter at the store, ex-shoplifter, I hope. I meet the shoplifter at the store, and then I put a pinhole camera on him and a microphone. And I send him off around the store, and no one in the store knows that he's got this. He's just an ordinary customer. And he talks to me about how he views situations. Oh, that would be easy. Oh, look at that. Oh, that would be difficult. Oh, that would be easy. Oh, look at that. And then he comes out, debriefs me, and I send him in to see if he can nick the stuff. And the idea, he nicks either my microphone or my pinhole camera, and the stuff he's nicked, he gives back. That's the idea of the exercise. So far, so good. Every time they've done it. But anyway, when I met this guy, the store manager said to me, "You wait till your shoplifter gets to the exit. When he gets to the exit, there is this massive security guard. He will scare anyone off. There is no way your shoplifter will get out of that store with any goods when he sees the security guard on the exit." Fascinating, eh? So, my shoplifter goes off around the store and saying how easy it is and what would make me a problem. And he eventually gets to the exit. As he gets to the exit, he stops and he looks at the exit and he says on his microphone, "Well, what about that? What a bit of luck. They've only gone and put a big fat git who I can outrun." You see, it's not logical, is it? Because he wasn't looking for a fight. His objective is to get away quickly. Again, it's about a matter of understanding what offenders are trying to do. That's the rationale they're working on. Now, on other days, I could spend ages talking to you about the various decisions they make, what influences those decisions, and how we can impact on those decisions by knowing the process that they go through. You know, but sending off in the store was a fascinating insight into just why things don't work. For example, am I okay for a couple more minutes?
Sure.
For example, in tagging systems they have in stores, you know the tags that on goods that when you go through the exit are not deactivated to send out an alarm. This is a thief's perspective on why they're useless. Okay. Option number one, peel the tag off the box. You'll see in a minute how they do it. Very easy. Option number two, take the good out of the box so it hasn't got a tag on anymore. Option number three, put it in a magic bag, which is a bag with foil on the inside and out. I have to be careful what I say this time, I'm giving you lots of ideas for committing crimes. I wouldn't try it. Option number four, when you go to the exit, find a way of getting around the exit gate so you don't have to walk right through them. Option number five, walk up to the exit gates, walk through, they often don't work anyway. Option number six, walk up to the exit gates, walk through, there'll be no one there to respond to the alarm when it goes off. Option number seven, walk up to the exit gates and deactivate it with a special device so they don't work. Option number eight, walk up to the exit gates, alarm goes off and there is someone there. The thing they're most likely to say is sorry, because they're always going off and they never stop you anyway. Option number nine, getting more serious now. Option number nine, go up to the exit gates. Alarm does go off and there is someone there. But you walk through with people who've got a pushchair or a wheelchair or a pram because they set them off anyway and they're much more likely to stop them than you. Option number 10. Is it 10? Walk through the gates. Alarm goes off and the guy is there and he comes up and he speaks to you and says, have you nicked the stuff? And you've got two really good options. One, you call what they say blag it. That means you ask them why they're stopping you, what's the evidence, and see if you can talk intelligently your way out of it. Or you run. But you see, the point is that when you hear their view of it, you begin to understand why they are able to negate the threat. And once again, I could have done exactly the same as with security guards, with CCTV, with alarm systems, with tagging systems, with property marking. You know, hearing their views about how they get around them provides a really useful way of beginning to think about how we must respond in a different way if we're going to impact seriously on crime. Now, what I would like to do, if I could, is just play you a few clips from my talk with offenders. The idea is that, let me just, so the stealing ones, I'll do the stealing ones. This is what they have to say.
I wouldn't ask you to in your trousers. The speed is important. The quicker you are, at this sort of level as well, it is quicker to get them down and concealed and out of the shop.
And desserts the perfect shape to just go straight down. I mean, that one doesn't even show up that much.
We usually just rip the casing open and just conceal them down your trousers. Just walk out the door. You can conceal in your trousers perhaps 5, 6, 7 at a time.
Each one of these packs now is worth £10. They say £50 just there. Whatever that thing's in the basket, that we can cover them with. And I'll see a loaf spray and that's when we put them on top.
Advantage for them being here for us as well is that they're right next to the checkout.
There seems to be hard to see. I can't see them.
Because you could just pretend you're standing in the queue and you pay for something else. And in the meantime, you could just spill your coat, please. £100 shop value, £50 cheap value.
Right, obviously I'm not too fussed about the customers, just the people on the meat counter. You know what I mean? So just perhaps one under there, and then it could just be a case of walking out the store. Well, these would be an instant seller. You're guaranteed to get a tenner for each one, and the size of them, none of them would be very hard to get. Kind of like 30 quid in one little shop. Ain't too bad.
The shop has always been that way because it's always been better than when it's come in shop. Mm-hmm. You don't feed it yourself or indoors.
Perhaps have a couple of them.
Okay, let me just I'll just play a couple more if I can, because I just want to. Now this guy. It's a different one. This guy is going to describe a robbery that he committed. And obviously it's reenacted. I'm only going to play a little bit because the bit I want to play on this is where he describes the technique he uses for getting goods off someone. And his point was that, have you ever thought what it's like to try and get people to part with their goods? You know, if you're robbing them, they don't exactly just comply. You know, you've got to get it right. And in this very quick slippy snip of video, he explains how he does it. It's quite a brutal attack, and I'd like you just to listen, if you would, to how he explains how he does it.
This is the
typical, but like this it for the city centre. This is where all the prostitutes hang out, the boys and girls. So this would be like a suitable place to look for a victim. That's one type of victim, you know, you've got your others that are laden with bags and stuff, and you can see, you know, computer case by that guy over there now. These are the kind of places where they take a foot off into the recesses. For us to choose in a victim, someone who obviously it's easy to take things off.
Now another, if I just play longer of that clip, he explains the point about the element of surprise, and that what he needs to do is to just keep people off their guard just a second, off the time. The minute they look at that watch, you punch them in the face, not knocking them out, but it's long enough for them to just knock them off their guard, you can then steal their goods. You know, it may look brutal, and it is brutal, but don't let us believe that in that brutality, there's not a logic there that we can begin to understand and begin to think about as a way of responding. Let me just play you these are a bit about tagging. Since I spoke about it, I'll just show you a little bit about what they say.
If this item was tagged, I'd actually remove the item from the packaging.
That's it.
You'd still be able to sell it as a new item.
And there's no damage to the product, is there? No.
If there was a tag inside the box, I think that may make a small difference. You've got to take the packaging anyway. I can't see anyone who's going to be wanting to tamper with these study. You just got to get in and out as quickly as possible. There's no visible alarm tag on the box. So again, it's just straight down the front. All it means is you've got to go for the ones with the more blazing, which is more value. Look, it's just a case of just taking the packaging with you. I think a lot of people would use a magic bag or perhaps look for something else. So I think all them with the eights are to be cleared out.
Okay, one final clip, and I promise something I want to stop. Promise. One final clip I'd like you to do. And the reason I want to show you this clip is for all the work I've done, for all the taking back to people to the scenes of the crime, all the interviews, the thing they keep coming up with is when you say, why did you choose that place? They say, because it was easy. Think about that for a second. They say, because it was easy. And here in this clip, perhaps more than any other, this girl explains just why she says it's easy. Listen to what she says at the very end of this, by the way, the very last thing she says.
Forgot. Security guard then stood at the side, so we wanted to make a dart through the door with anything. I'm pretty glad that he's somewhere else. See, here's a meat counter, seeing if there's anything decent to take from there. Right, I'm going to the wine now. I'd take my chances with both of them boxes. We're going to get in the same amount of trouble whether you get caught with one or two, so I might as well take both of them. So there we go, walking down. He's not there at the door, so here we go. Here we go out the door with a wine, no one's stopping me, no one's keeping me. Easy peasy.
That's what they say. But that's what they say whether they're committing a robbery, whether they're committing a fraud. And you know, just to finish this work with the offenders in prison, the fraudsters, these are major league fraudsters who are saying exactly the same thing. They say because it's easy. Now, my point is simply this, that we have to start to think about the way we're responding to crime. When it continues to go on, we continue to fail to take account of what offenders say, and yet they continue to do it with abandonment. We're just about to, we've just done a study where we've interviewed persistent offenders and drug dealers in prison to get their views. They're not public yet. But, you know, once again, what comes through this work is this sense of the fact that we know we'll get caught, but it won't be until we've made a lot of gains in the first place. And surely this is not a good basis, neither a rational one, nor indeed an economically sensible one, in order to base a strategy for responding to crime. My point's not, of course, that in speaking to offenders we have all the answers. My point is that in not speaking to them, we miss some of the answers. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. I'm not. Ah, okay. But just got caught. First of all, I don't speak to people who are just in jail. Some of those we've spoken to have not been to jail. Not that it's a big threat, mind you. The question about people who haven't been caught is a more difficult one. You know, what I did do is I asked offenders, do you know of anybody who commits crime regularly and has never been caught? And the answer is generally no. There aren't that many people, in my view, who've committed crime regularly and never been caught. Having said that, when we were doing the work last summer, with I did two projects over the summer. One was on property marking. Another one was robbers of ATM machines. You know the ATM machines where you draw your money out? I spoke to robbers who robbed ATM machines. And one of the robbers I spoke to had never been caught ever. And he'd been shoplifting, which is his main crime, for 2 years and claimed he'd never been caught. So, and he said he stole at least three or four times a week from stores and never been caught. Now, two things to say. These are offenders speaking. You know, we can't be sure they're telling the truth, and there's no easy way of finding out. And I met him through a drug rehabilitation centre. But the evidence suggests that if there are some that are out there that are prolific, there aren't that many that don't get caught eventually.
Two questions. When I was told security guards and department store detectives, then I noticed that they are far more interested in me if I don't have a shopping basket with me. And I noticed that all of the people in your video did not have a shopping basket with them. Is there some correlation? Is this a well-known sign that something is about to happen? And the second question, you mentioned these magic bags. Did you find other interesting technical aids, in particular with CCTV cameras, do people try to use flashlights to drive the automatic game control to saturation and just have the rest of the image dark and that sort of thing? Because some vendors market that they have better algorithms to avoid that, but is that actually a problem?
Is what specifically a problem? Sorry.
You talked about problems that artificial light make a camera useless.
Yes.
Do perpetrators use artificial light deliberately in order to disable a camera?
Right. There's a good film about to come out. It was on robbery actually, and I was asked to go down and speak about the world of real life robbery, and they showed me the first half of the film. It's fantastic actually. It's about a bank robbery, and their methodology is precisely that, oddly enough, in the film. My answer is no, but the answer is no, and the answer is no because of this. But one of the things that I've had to get used to is understanding that from offender's point of view, crime is easy. You know, it's not that difficult. I was doing a radio interview last week, and the interviewer was asking about identity fraud, which I've done a lot of work on, and about how useful. Well, I'll tell you what it was. On The Independent on Sunday, they had a major lead article Department of Work and Pensions selling information, and the question came up, what can you do with a national insurance number? And the answer is not a great deal in the short run. It's a lot of work to build that up, and you don't need to. It's much easier to go and bribe someone and get the information for yourself and get the whole lot. That crime is relatively easy. So you don't need to go through complicated measures. You're not the robber, walk up the counter, give me the money and walk out. You know, it's easy. It's easy if you're good at it and you know what to do. Your point about bags is an interesting one. I've worked with quite a few retailers who've now got clues as to what is a suspicious shopper. But you have to be very careful how you implement that. For us, it's very, very difficult to stereotype. You know, if I was to stereotype a robber, a shoplifter, it would be young man, T-shirt, jacket on top, wearing a baseball cap, jeans. Now, how many people walk around the city centre, you know, in that sort of attire? It's very, very difficult to stereotype in a meaningful way. Certainly having bags can be both an indication of theft, you've got something to steal from, and an indication of not having them can be an indication of theft. And in the abstract, they're very difficult to interpret. Clearly, acting suspiciously can. But whatever does that mean? You know, in the real world, where you've got people, you know, much lower down the pay chain, who've got to interpret this, you have to be very careful about the sort of advice that you give that's meaningful. So I'm not saying that they weren't suspicious of you because you didn't have a bag, but they might have been suspicious of you for the fact that you were alone, that you were wandering around too much, that you didn't look like you knew where you were going. All those are plausible too.
Okay, one more there. Michael, can I come with you? Sorry, I'm the audience. Everybody get that. Go and pick it up. Sorry, it was first someone behind you.
It's okay.
Every time I go through customs in Hong Kong, they stop me if I look at them. But if I don't make eye contact, they just ignore me.
There's your answer.
Do the people you talk to do the same thing?
Well, not making eye contact is very, very important, actually, because from an offender's point of view, you don't attract any attention to yourself. I mean, one of the things they teach you in robbery school is when you're a getaway driver, and you're outside, waiting outside for your accomplice to come out with the loot, is don't look at anyone. Keep looking straight ahead. If anyone asks you anything, don't look at them, for the very fact that they may get features of your face. So in that sense, it's good advice not to do so. Don't forget, the art of a good crime is to blend into the background. And I've written an article, actually, recently about the sorts of resources and skills offenders use in order to be successful. And one of them is to blend in. And, you know, you don't blend in by staring people out. You blend in by just acting as casually and as normally as you can. So my advice would be don't stare at them. Yeah.
Are you going to pick up the microphones down here?
There's one economic aspect that I think I read online where retailers in the U.S. Tell their store workers not to stop people if they see them shoplift.
Yeah.
And because that's just... In their bottom line, they already account for the amount of debt that they're going to get, and it's just not worth their hassle to stop these people, create a scene, or even go and go after them in court. It's just not worth it.
Well, my interpretation would be slightly different, although along similar lines. And one of the things we have to remember out there in the real world, rather than in the classroom, it's an unqualified observation of logic that crime is unacceptable, offenders must be stopped. But in the real world, there's a cost to preventing crime. And any organisation, in my view, can choose how much he wants to be a victim by determining how much he wants to spend on protecting itself. We could all protect the places where we lived by making security very strict. And we could do it, and it would probably work. But there's an economically rational thing to do. We also got a decision to make about the sort of home we want to live in and how we want it to appear to others. So there's an economically rational point in saying it's not worth spending too much stopping this. We will accept some of this stuff is going to go missing. But it can manifest itself in a variety of ways. One of the problems that retailers have in the UK and the United States is that if they stop someone, they've got to wait for the police to arrive. And keeping someone off the shore, off the shop floor, looking after a shoplifter who's agitated, getting aggressive, getting annoyed, is not desirable. It's both expensive and it makes staff upset. They're employed to sell things, not to keep shoplifters abusing them occupied. So, in a different way, the police in the United Kingdom, in one area in the south, have made it clear they're not going to respond to low-level shoplifting incidents. And so they have made an economic decision based on what they consider acceptable. So my point would be, if you say is the fact, then I'd be slightly surprised if they were tolerating it. What tends to happen is if they catch someone stealing them something, the object is to take it off them, stop them and take it off them, and then let them go on the basis they've achieved their objective of getting the goods back. I'd be surprised if in reality they let them go away with the goods regardless. That doesn't strike me as good practice or standard practice. But, you know, the real world is that we have to be economically rational. And that does mean that we've got to tolerate some offences. And the issue is, what are you prepared to tolerate and what are you prepared to risk?
Okay, maybe we'll have a last question.
I was just wondering, to what extent do you think a CCTV footage would be useful to criminals themselves? And when you look at a CCTV camera, you don't know who's manning it. And, you know, if it's public space, then there's no clear evidence of if you trust a CCTV camera, whether it's linked up to the police or it's linked up to the mafia.
I'm not so sure that they're worried about the fact that it could be linked up to, if it's linked up to a mafia, all the better. But the issue about CCTV is it's logical for them to assume it is being watched. You know, if you assume it is being watched, then you can guard against it. But, you know, it's not that difficult. I've spoken to loads of offenders who told me techniques they use in order to make sure that even if they are being watched, you can't tell what's going on. You know something, I've been thinking recently, I don't know if there are many football fans here. You know, there's a lot of criticism of referees and they play back the incidents after on Match of the Day and we get a chance to judge it in slow motion. And I would say on the majority of those times when they're playing it in slow motion, I still don't know what happened. I still can't make a judgment about who was at fault. You know, this idea because we've got it on camera means that we've got them. This isn't real world. It's not like that. It's very difficult to decipher what's going on. And, you know, I mean, and offenders are clever. I've got to be careful how much I say, of course, because I taught them all their tricks. And I don't want to teach you. But, you know, there are ways you use your body, your clothing, the movement of hand to make sure that you don't make it obvious. And if it's not obvious, then a bored, unpaid, lowly paid person sitting watching a camera miles away is really going to need a lot of enthusiasm to A, notice it. And, of course, even if they do notice it, we already know that's only part of the problem. Even if this is the reality, they're sitting there with all these screens, right? And they work in different cases, but not every camera goes onto a screen. They might flash, you know, at certain points in time. So, first of all, they've got to be looking at the screen. Well, there's loads of reasons why they might not be doing that. But just say they are looking at the screen. Then they've got to have that incident come up in front of them. That's possibly not as likely as you might think. So it does come up in front of them, they've got to see it. Then they've got to interpret it as being a crime incident. Then they've got to be motivated to do something about it. And when they do something about it, someone's got to respond. You know, no wonder my offenders are not that worried, because they know that they do it regularly and no one ever stops them. And therein lies the real world issue of committing crime.
I was just wondering about to what extent, if I'm a criminal and I've got CCTV, you know, I'm sitting behind the screen. I'm the one who's behind the screen. It's not about me.
If you're the one behind the screen?
Yes,
exactly. So if there's an operator working in collusion?
Well, the operator is the criminal, because the criminal is the operator.
Yeah.
Because it's physical.
Well, Well, it obviously could do, but...
Because you see, that's not fair if you are saying that, oh, this is CCTV is denying that that point is that not. You see, CCTV is actually CCTV, you can't really make out what's the objective of the operator.
No, exactly.
In that sense.
No, exactly. Well, I mean, there are clearly, I mean, just to bring this full circle though, under the security industry authority regulations, in order to get a license, you have to get through three sets of criteria, three hurdles. One is you have to prove your identity. Two, you have to undergo independent assessment of competence. And three, you have to pass a criminal records check. So, in the future, that won't be so easy anyway. But I don't, to be honest, I don't think it's a major issue because it's just not likely to happen in the first place.
Okay, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.